Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. I'm going to be talking today with some of my homies from Chefs Collaborative. The big Chefs Collaborative Summit, their annual summit, is coming up in Boulder in just a couple of weeks. And to that end, I thought it might be a good idea to chat a little bit about the group and what directions they're going in coming weeks, months, and years. They have a bit of new leadership team going on. So we'll be welcoming to the program today Alicia Fowler. She is the program director for Chefs Collaborative. Previously, she helped to create and grow the Alliance for Climate Education, which is now educating over 1 million high school students about climate science and solutions. Can't have too much of that. And our other guest is Michael Levitin, a chef and chairman of the board for Chefs Collaborative, as well as being the chef owner for Lumiere, and the chef partner for Area 4 in Boston, Massachusetts. He's a 7-time James Beard Foundation Award nominee and recipient of national awards from Food and Wine, Bon Appetit, Gourmet and Saveur. He's been the chair for Chefs Collaborative since 2010. Welcome to both of you. I'm excited to chat about the group. It's an organization that's been around for quite a long time, but it seems to be kind of growing in prominence. So why don't you guys give us a little bit of a history of the Chefs Collaborative and tell us more about the focus for the 2014 summit.
Certainly. The quick history is that the collaborative was founded in 1993 on a beach in Hawaii by a group of really just incredibly visionary chefs at an old ways summit called Food Choices 2000. Mm-hmm. And so the topic of conversation then was the emerging role of chefs and the understanding that we could help educate the guest and the larger community about foods and farming and cooking that is better for the planet, better for our health, better for society.
Amazing. You guys really were visionaries because in 1993, I mean, I've been in the food business my entire life, and I don't really remember 1993 as being any kind of a major year for like, oh my God, suddenly right. The light bulb went off. I mean, you know, like it just wasn't really on the radar so much, right?
No, and even, you know, I moved to California and started cooking there in 1988. And, you know, even though some of this stuff was going on, sustainability just wasn't even a part of the lexicon.
Yeah.
You know, and to think about how far we've come over the past 20-plus years and really just even how much has happened in the past five is truly remarkable. And,
yeah.
It, you know, put in that perspective what those folks on the beach 20 years ago were thinking about and talking about was incredibly visionary.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, just to kind of put it into a context, so I'm thinking like when Chez Panisse opened, that's about 28 years ago now? So Alice was kind of the bellwether and then Jeremiah
early
Tower.
Mid-70s, yeah.
Yeah, something like so. Yeah, so that's kind of when that those ideas started bubbling up into at least public consciousness, sort of. And she was really seen as kind of an outlier. And then
Right. Obviously
this group was formed. And some of the earliest members were people like Peter Hoffman, right?
Yeah,
who
Peter
else
Hoffman,
was?
John Ash, Rick Bayless, Joyce Goldstein,
right.
Susan Feniger, Nobu Matsuhisa.
Wow.
I mean, it was
cast.
Really a very impressive group.
Very.
A lot of those folks are still in some ways involved even now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is fabulous.
Yeah, no, it's great. I loved it. I didn't really know much about Chefs Collaborative, although I have occasionally interviewed people for magazine articles and stuff. But I went to the summit last year and I met amazing people, heard some great speakers, and it was just like the whole thing was so impressive. I was just, you know, delighted by it. So tell us a little bit about what your focus is for the 2014 summit, because that's kind of a new direction for you guys. It's all about scale and moving mountains, right?
Right, and, you know, yeah, exactly. The theme really is moving mountains and scaling change.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for many years, the organization, you know, because of who was interested in these things, was, you know, populated by chefs like myself with, you know, small restaurants, chef-owned restaurants, and really wasn't really thinking real big.
Right.
But the more that I've been involved and the more that we've seen change over the past decade, scale is clearly occurring and needs to be occurring more.
Right.
You know, and now for us as an organization, you know, we keep coming back to the idea of thinking big and acting big and having a really big impact. You know, it's all well and good if, you know, chefs like myself who don't feed a ton of people,
right.
You know, if we have an impact, that's great, but we need it to have a much larger societal impact, and that's where the idea of scale really comes into play.
Who is going to be speaking at this event, and what was your reason for selecting some of them?
Well, yeah, again, you know,
in
talking about the idea of scale,
yeah.
You know, we've got Mel Coleman from Nyman Ranch,
right?
Hugo Matheson from The Kitchen and The Kitchen Communities, Mo Siegel of Celestial Seasonings.
Oh, wow.
We've got Ari Weisenswig from Zingerman's, Nate Appleman from Chipotle.
Right.
I mean, we've got Mary Sue Milliken from the Board of Grill. We've just got this incredible group of people who are used to dealing at a scale that perhaps sustainability hasn't really been talked about so much in the past.
Well, I think, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's why I was really excited about your focus this year and also being part of that, because in the course of the last 5 years that I've been doing this radio program, what I see are the difficulties that create a problem in scaling this up is really has to do with infrastructure, with, you know, production facilities, with aggregation and distribution and
right.
You know, like all of that stuff has had, I think, has sort of lagged behind both the chef's perception of what the food system should be and also what consumers are increasingly beginning to demand. So I think it's great that you guys are talking about scale on the restaurant level and bringing in partners who are
right. Well, you know, and you know, it, you know, look, sustainable choices, depending upon where you are on the proverbial food chain, from you know, small chef-owned restaurant all the way up to organizations like, you know, Compass or Sodexo.
Right.
You know, the sourcing challenges are different from where you are on that chain.
That's right.
And as he's pointed out, there are also a lot of logistical challenges there as well.
Yeah.
The collaborative to me is really fascinating because we're uniquely positioned, looking backwards and forwards, both to forward facing to consumers and backward facing to producers. And we're sort of that midpoint. And, you know, what we're in many ways really trying to do is to help create this perfect storm of supply and demand.
Right.
Because, frankly, without that working economically, sustainability is just not going to happen.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's not sustainable if it isn't economically sustainable. I remember somebody saying that to me like 5 years ago. And I was
right.
Like,
yeah. You know, I like to joke that the first rule of running a sustainable restaurant is keep your doors open.
Yeah. So true, Michael. So
yeah,
tell us.
Yeah, true, but unfortunate in some ways.
Well,
it necessarily involves more compromise than sometimes I'm willing to do.
Yeah, I'm sure it involves a ton of compromise. I mean, you can't, you know, especially if you have a restaurant that is beholden to other investors and so forth. I mean, it's kind of a collective decision on where your budget is, I'm sure. I mean, I've never run a restaurant, only worked in a few of them, so I don't really know the deal. But I bet there's a lot of give and take back and forth about who you're going to buy from, what kind of price point you can go to before, you know, the whole thing sort of collapses, like, you know,
right. You know, the other thing that I speak about a lot is the idea that, you know, our daily purchasing decisions, sort of no matter where you are on this food chain, involve a very complex multivariable calculus.
Yes.
And those variables shift day to day.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so it's really it's a challenge, but it's a fun one most of the time.
I hope so. Well, you wouldn't be still in the business. You've been doing this a long time, right?
Yes.
So tell us a little bit of who the members are of Chefs Collaborative, because, I mean, you mentioned that it's a lot of sort of, you know, it started with smaller fine dining establishments primarily. But do you have a lot of membership from, say, quick service restaurants or institutional buyers?
We're covering the whole spectrum now.
Uh-huh.
So nearly all 50 states. Chefs, food business owners, activists, culinary students, butchers, authors.
Right.
We've got them all. And, you know, farmers, ranchers, fishermen, you know,
and these are all members.
You know,
wow.
Are members at this point.
Mm-hmm. And you guys have been very active in creating programs that raise awareness of certain issues, such as, you know, trying to buy different kinds of seafood in order to take the pressure off of those seafood stocks that may be overfished at this point. So you call them the trash fish dinners.
Right.
And then there's another, you've done a lot of programs around antibiotics and livestock. Can you flesh that out a little bit more for us and tell us about any other initiatives Chefs Collaborative has been working on?
You know, we've been involved with seafood sourcing, and for years we put out this thing called Seafood Solutions.
Mm-hmm.
We put out a while back Green Chefs Blue Oceans in conjunction with the Blue Ocean Institute, which was a mm-hmm. training tool. Our recent efforts have been around, as you said, trash fish, or the so-called underutilized species.
Right.
You know, I realize that,
I like
trash
that
fish
name
is,
better.
You know, it's a bit of a marketing term, admittedly, but it does help to grab people's attention and, you know, make us aware in each sort of geographical region of all the different sort of seafood sourcing challenges in those areas.
Right, sure. I have to say that as a marketing tool, trash fish, I can understand how it's an attention getter. At the same time, I don't think it really does justice. I prefer to see another name like unloved fish.
Yeah.
Or
right. Well, you know, or it's tough, though, because, you know,
yeah.
unloved fish doesn't quite have the same,
no.
same grab.
Yeah, no, but I
you know,
think that's
the idea really is to find ways to be, instead of targeting you know, the you know, sort of the favorites,
yeah.
right, which worked for a while but now has left us in a very precarious position, especially here in New England.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be rethinking how we cook and what we cook, you know, and we need to be looking at what's out there now and,
right.
and cooking those seafoods.
And encouraging fishermen to want to fish for that.
Right.
And learn
that,
how
you know,
to use bycatch is what you're talking about.
You know, the
about,
creation
yeah.
of markets.
Right.
So, you know, here in New England, we have, the you know, an issue with the spiny dogfish. There's,
yes.
There's an awful lot of them.
Yep.
And it would be great if we could get people to eat them. But one, it's making people aware of it, teaching them how to cook it, how to make
yeah.
it delicious. Two, there's a processing issue, so that we need to get that attendant industry up and running. And then we've
yes.
got to make it viable for the fishermen to go out there and actually harvest these things.
Right. What about stuff like sea robin? I know that's one fish that's that was considered a trash fish that's starting to make its way onto New England menus. Are you seeing more of that or not so
yeah,
much?
Yeah, you know, even something like sea robin brings up some different issues. You know, they're mm-hmm. a tiny fish.
Yeah.
Delicious, you know, firm flesh and really nice textured, but you're talking about maybe 2 ounces of meat from
oh, exactly.
a fish that's a little dangerous to fillet. You know, I would never advocate a home cook doing it because there are some spines on there that are potentially problematic.
Wow, no kidding. I had
yeah,
no idea,
Yeah, and same
Michael.
Thing with, although there's a lot of processing around Acadian redfish
uh-huh.
Or ocean perch, depending on, you know, which name you like
that's
to
use.
That's
what I'm familiar with, yeah.
But again, that's one that you wouldn't necessarily want the home cook doing, but that's available now,
uh-huh.
and the stocks are seemingly in good supply.
Right.
You know, one of the issues here is that these are stocks that we don't have data on, because nobody was really using them, so that
mm-hmm.
why would you collect the data on them?
Right.
And
so
this is one
of
the things that we've been advocating for in a number of different arenas, but, you know, we really need to be looking at the whole of the ecosystem and
mm-hmm.
trying to gather more information and then taking an ecosystems management approach to how we harvest stocks within that
yep.
particular ecosystem.
Yeah, fascinating. So really it's such an education process because it's not just chefs, it's not just consumers, but it's also your chef constituency, and then you have to work with fishermen to ensure that they understand what your needs are. And then, as you just said, the processing. It's
right.
like if fish houses are not prepared to process this, how do you encourage them and incentivize them to do it? How can you command enough volume to make it worth their while to retrain their people, right?
Exactly.
I mean, it sounds like that's what the issue is.
Right. So this seemingly very simple,
right.
simple idea
right.
becomes fraught with nuance
yeah.
in terms of actually affecting some whole some big change.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in other words, there is no such thing as a small change.
There's essentially such a thing as a small change. I think there's no such thing as an easy solution.
Yeah, right. That's more to the point. How has your chef constituency responded to, say, working with different kinds of seafood and encouraging their local processors and fishermen to maybe bring aboard, you know, something different than the usual?
You know, I can't speak to the whole of the community, but we're definitely seeing more and more of it, especially in the coastal regions, although we just did a fabulous trash fish dinner in Denver.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's no native seafood there.
Obviously.
So everything's coming from afar, but to the extent that we can get even chefs in a landlocked area to understand the value of you know, sort of eating from or cooking from the bottom of the food chain and using these underutilized species.
Right.
That's a huge win.
Yeah, huge.
I mean, we even did a trash fish dinner in Vegas.
Cool.
Yeah.
You guys really
sort of
are
like
cool.
The least sustainable place on earth. But.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. So, Alicia, why don't you pipe in here and tell us a little bit about how you've you know, been organizing some of the programs? Because obviously, this falls into your bailiwick, right? So these programs that are educating chefs.
It's exciting to hear from the program director side of things, but you know, we've really got this outstanding list of about 40 speakers who are queued up and really span the culinary world.
Yeah.
And we worked with a committee of our Chefs Collaborative board members and chefs to select speakers who could hit on the core issues we're addressing, including just what you were talking about, scaling sustainable business practices.
Right.
We have things like hands-on chef skills like butchering and working with invasive species. We have somebody bringing in a wild boar. They're going to butcher it up and roast it.
That would be Adam.
So we have really these great element of both tackling these large mountains and then hand-in-hand with that, getting chefs into the kitchens across Boulder, not just going to be in some conference hotel. And you're really going to get to pick up your knife and you're going to work on skills. And folks are going to leave with really tools and a network to help them make changes in their kitchens and in their businesses.
That's awesome.
We really tried to pick people who are best positioned to share powerful narratives about their journeys, and chefs and food professionals with these hands-on skills they could pass on to others.
That sounds
great. One person I want to mention that's speaking is the governor of Colorado. He's a former brewmaster.
Wow.
He calls himself a recovering geologist, and he's going to share this great story of how he went from brewmaster to the governor of the entire state of Colorado. So he's going to really help us kick things off with this whole theme on
September
28th.
Yeah, that's really cool. So September 28th. In fact, if anybody is interested in following this or going to it, maybe a little last minute at this point, but it is still, I think, possible to sign up for this, especially if you're in the Colorado area, you don't need housing or whatever. But, it seems to me like they have enough. They've got a lot of hotels out there in Boulder.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and flights are actually still really reasonable.
They are very reasonable.
One of the things about this position is it's in the middle of the country. So we're really well positioned there, and we do still have tickets while it is selling quite fast, but we do have a lot way for people to plug in if they want to come, and all those tickets are just on our website at chefscollaborative.org.
Are you guys going to be doing an audiovisual feed or anything like that, like a TEDx
looking at it. We do have a number of videographers and photographers coming, and we're going to repurpose content really quickly, but we're focused on capturing the content and then getting it out to our membership as soon as possible.
Right. Sounds good. So let me ask you this, and then we're going to take a short break after that, but when you guys organize, say, the campaign for educating chefs about trying to buy livestock that has not been treated with antibiotics prophylactically, which is to say commodity livestock, and certainly a tremendous price point differential between that and you know, animals that are raised in a more humane or sort of more, I hate to use the word sustainable, I'm so sick of it, but anyway, in that manner of like not using prophylactic drugs. How do you make that kind of scale change? Because that is a scale change, right? I mean, how can people sort of push their investors or change their purchasing programs? I mean, it seems like it's kind of a big thing to tackle unless you are like a chef owner and you can just unilaterally make that kind of decision for yourself.
I think that there are a number of different ways, to skin this proverbial cat.
Yeah.
That, you know, at least to a large extent, you know, the selling of sustainability is an important part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to the extent that we can subtly and without hitting our customers over the head, but educate them into why the products we're serving justify the increased price point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why they're better for the environment, better for our health, better mm-hmm. for
better for the animals,
economy,
certainly.
Better on all those different levels. Mm-hmm. If we can justify that, then a lot of people really are willing to spend a few extra shekels.
That's cool. Very good.
But I think also, a lot of what we've done in the past and will continue to do is about training chefs in ways to, if you're using the whole animal, if you can find a way to sell the whole animal, you're certainly going to get a much better deal and you can generate more profit for your, meat purchasing dollars.
Right.
Than if you're just buying middle meats.
But then you run into the whole problem of say you're not a particularly upscale, you're just kind of like a mid-level, not QSR dining, not quick service restaurant, but you're somewhere in between and you want to buy better. But it's like, isn't there a tremendous learning curve? And isn't it really hard for just sort of the average run-of-the-mill restaurant to sell, sort of unusual cuts to their constituency? I mean, this is the problem that I see with buying whole animals. First, you have the additional labor cost.
Right.
Which has to be passed on. So even though you might have saved money on the meat, you might also be, spending more on having somebody cut it up for you. And then the whole issue of again, it's the same thing as the trash fish of like educating consumers that, a chuck roll or, something like that, or, buy a braised dish instead of steak.
Right. No, you're absolutely right.
That's very challenging. This is a
long and difficult road.
Yeah.
But I think that the more that we are able to make folks aware, mm-hmm. The more we're able to do this. And I think what we've certainly seen over the past, decade is that more and more people, this is increasing in importance to more and more people every day.
I agree, especially the antibiotics issue.
So that there is some, some groundswell of movement.
Mm-hmm.
And as that continues, the delta, the cost differential between commodity and properly raised will continue to come down.
Right, right. Well, we're going to take a short sponsor drop break. So we'll be right back in 30 seconds or so with Michael Levitin and Alicia Fowler from Chefs Collaborative. Stay tuned. We have much, much more to talk about.
You're listening to Lung by Iggy Dean.
That has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You on the Heritage Radio Network. My name is Katie Kiefer, and we're talking Chefs Collaborative today because the Chefs Collaborative is holding its annual summit in Boulder on September 28th. My guests are the chairman of the board, Michael Levitin, a well-known chef, and Alicia Fowler, the program director for the organization. And guys, I want to go back to this issue of scale, since that's what you're all about. And I just wanted to, one of the questions I had in preparing for this is like, is there any way that you guys can measure the change in purchasing that some of your members are doing in response to the programs that you offer, such as education about antibiotics and livestock supply or trash fish? And are you able to sort of gauge the success or failure of your programs and then kind of create some sort of a feedback loop both for yourselves and for industry to connect with?
Yeah, absolutely. We've done this in the past, where we gather some questionnaire data, mm-hmm. and to sort of track the changes that people are making and see what sort of impact that's having.
Right.
And as I said before, we're sort of in this unique position where, as you pointed out, that data can go backwards and forwards.
Right.
So out to the consumer, and we can see where it's having an effect there, but then also translate that back to the producers and, you know, hopefully influence their decision-making as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, because my next question was, is how much does your organization engage directly with commodity livestock production or sort of commodity seafood producers? I know much less about the seafood industry or dairy, but I know that there are, you know, big entities that control large volumes of these products that typical restaurants tend to be, you know, their customers. And how much can you guys actually talk to these guys, or do you actually talk to these guys to say, hey, look, you know, we're going to buy more, like, for instance, with Chipotle having its difficulties in sourcing antibiotic-free beef last year, you know, it's a question about how much leverage they can put onto those commodity beef organizations to maybe change some of their programs. And I'm wondering how much you guys engage to do that, you know, to funnel that information along to them.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, we're not really engaging with big ag directly.
Why not?
I think that we've I think probably on both ends, you know, we have been reticent to reach out to them, mm-hmm. and seen, you know, not seen, and I think that they, you know, are not necessarily interested in dealing with us at this point. Although, you know, hopefully as we begin to scale up, we can affect that change and we can begin to have those dialogues. But you're seeing a lot more now with, you know, folks like the Nyman Ranch, who we've been working with for quite a while.
Right, and who are a big
there are
sponsor.
A lot more,
right.
Never Had It, Never Will programs now.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of, you know, even one of the big pork companies now is launching their own sort of heritage or naturally raised line. Yep. You're seeing everybody get into the sphere now.
Well, Purdue has just announced that they're no longer going to feed the antibiotics that go into the human medicine system to their poultry flocks, which, you know, you can see that as a tremendous victory, or you can see it as a bit of a whitewash in a certain level. I'm a cynic. I see it as like, well, I'm still going to use antibiotics, but...
But
that's
even that,
huge.
Now, and you're right, and I wouldn't disagree with that, but I also think that we need to, you know, let's look at it in some ways for what it is, and that, look, now they're sensitive to the issue,
mm-hmm.
right? And
yeah.
the tip, you know, we've in some ways begun to achieve that tipping point. If we can continue to push things in the direction that we have, perhaps in 5 years it's an announcement that they're not going to be using antibiotics prophylactically, period.
Right, and
right?
That obviously
so,
is the goal.
You know, this is all about baby steps, right?
Yeah.
We're not going to change the system overnight.
No, definitely not.
That's completely unrealistic. But the hope is, you know, by making little bits of progress every day, we can affect some major change. It's really going to be better for
everyone,
for all
including
of us.
The producers and including
and
the commodity
thing,
business.
One thing I want to add there really quick is that, you know, the summit, the Sustainable Food Summit, is such a great venue for us to have those dialogues. And the more we're able to engage more directly with folks and have people there to have those hard conversations, talk about their trials and tribulations with scale and with making progress and hear what everyone's thinking. I mean, it's such a natural venue for us to be able to engage directly with our strong partners and allies and then also grow these new relationships that will be really critical for making those baby steps into a lot more.
Right. I mean, I would encourage the group actually to engage more directly with, you know, with some of the trade organizations that are running our livestock supply, et cetera. Just because I will tell you from my own personal experience, and I've spent quite a bit of time interviewing these people and going to their conferences, they really, truly live in a silo. They honestly don't have much sense of what the food industry is actually doing because they're so busy providing their own feedback loop to themselves of how great they are and how people like you guys are out to ruin their business. And there's a real level of, I'm serious. This is, I mean, I am not making this up. It's like truth is truly strange. Than fiction in this way. And I think that if there was more dialogue between some of the trade groups or, you know, like there might be a bit more progress because there
right,
would
no,
be
and
sort
we,
of
we,
breaking down some
you know,
of those
the American Landlord has been a sponsor in the past. And, you know, so
well, yeah.
we certainly are having some of that dialogue.
Right.
And, you know, obviously, look, if it's going to affect change, I think we would really love to, you know, we'll do anything.
Okay. Cool. Well, let me try to.
In terms of trying to
let me
to
try
move
to make
change,
that happen
you know?
For you. No, because I do have connections with the industry, and they do seem to, for whatever reason, listen to me. I don't know why. Maybe not so much now that I wrote this very rude piece for the Huffington Post about their antibiotic policies, but those are changing, and I'm happy about that. But I want to move on because we're rapidly approaching the sort of final third of this, and I have so many more questions. When I was talking with Chris Arnold, we were having sort of a little discussion about the scale panel that I'm moderating at the thing, and Chris Arnold was on the call with us, and he made this really interesting suggestion, which I thought was fascinating and also surprising. He said that there are no across-the-board standards that chefs can endorse that will send a clear message about production methods to the various industries. And do you guys see that as a potential goal for this conference, for, you know, future, you know, discussions? And ultimately, you set this this kind of level of standards about animals, say animal livestock production in terms of animal welfare, what kind of drugs they get, what kind of feed they get, you know, that kind of stuff. Do you see that standardization of demands as a possibility even?
I guess I would say that, I would take a very non-committal answer here and say yes and no.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes, that would be great.
Right.
On the other hand, no, there are so many different little things that go into a purchasing decision.
Uh-huh.
and an animal husbandry decision, that it's very often far too nuanced to just come out with a black and white answer for a very gray issue.
Interesting.
Depends on how deep you want to go down the rabbit hole, but even let's take a never had it, never will.
Yeah.
Meat program.
Right.
Right. So the question then becomes, well, what do you do with an animal that you do have to treat?
Right.
Right. You take it out of the program and you dump it on the commodity market, and then
That's what happens right now. Yeah.
Right. I'm not a real big fan of that. Because a rancher is going to get more money for their never had it, never will, they may be subconsciously less willing to administer antibiotics to a sick animal,
mm-hmm.
Which becomes a, humane
issue. That becomes a humane issue. Mm-hmm. I understand.
If you come across the grass-fed versus grain-finished thing, you run into a lot of sort of geographical issues, and different health issues, and there's as much as I would love to say, yeah, here we've got this great black and white answer. I think the best in many ways that we can do, and this is what the collaborative has preached for a long time, is to make people aware of a lot of these different issues and to help them make the decisions that are most right for them.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time.
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah. I mean, I understand what you're saying. I also think it's possible to have standards that are not as draconian as what you suggest, like the never ever. To me, that's just frankly unrealistic. I don't think that you can produce beef on the scale that we produce it, for example, and say that you are never going to treat a sick animal with antibiotics. And I don't think that anyone, even if you are the most earthy, crunchy person on the earth, is going to say, oh, no, it's better to let the animal just be sick and potentially die. Like, nobody's
right.
going to say that. I mean,
okay, but then,
people really drill into this stuff.
The questions are, getting some standardization of agreement across a lot of different platforms for, how much time is time for the antibiotic to get out of the system, then you're no longer able to advertise never had it, never will, in terms of distinguishing yourself from
right.
another.
But if we had a better beef supply overall, you wouldn't need to, right?
I'm sorry?
If you had a better beef supply overall, that would no longer be a way. Yes, it would take away that marketing strategy, but at the same time, it would be float everybody's boat a little bit better.
Right, but by the same token, it's that marketing strategy which has pushed us to this point of,
true.
Now that we're having this conversation about antibiotics.
Right, right, right.
Right.
You're absolutely right.
And
Michael.
So, it makes for some difficult decision-making sometimes.
Yes, it really does. It was very complex.
But that being said, all of these conversations are important, and they're moving us in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
So even if the answers are not easy, the fact of the matter is that we're making such great progress because these topics are coming up now every day, and people are thinking a lot more about them and coming
yes.
up with new creative ways to solve them. And the big takeaway is the more that we continue to have these conversations, the more impact we're going to have.
Yes, absolutely. No, I mean, I think there is no greater bellwether than the community of chefs who have done probably more than anyone else. The the yeoman's work of pushing this, better food idea across the board. You know, where it's not just the purview of the wealthy.
One thing we're finding now is just that we're hearing more and more that policymakers want to hear from chefs. It's not just industries.
Yes.
It's policymakers and decision makers. They're really saying that, like, somebody initially called it to me a non-traditional voice on an issue when it was about Bristol Bay and Pebble Mine up in Alaska. But it's not becoming a non-traditional. It's becoming a really important voice.
Yeah.
And Chef Sam Cass at the White House said that hearing from chefs helps him do his job when he's making decisions about things that affect the food industry. So they really have a unique ability to be heard and leverage their collective voice because chefs are on the front lines of these issues every single day.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's something we're really passionate about, is elevating the chef voice and helping people take action on these core issues.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I read an interesting study just recently that came out from McKinsey, which is, you know, that sort of industry policy analysis group. I mean, I can't describe them very well, but they came out with a study just a couple of days ago that I happened to notice that basically sustainability, just in the last 2 years, just the idea of sustainability across the board of industry has become much more important. Now, granted, 70% of these respondents said the most important part of their sustainability effort was communicating their efforts to the public. In other words, like they make one tiny step and then they spend millions of dollars in marketing money to, you know, tell the world that they're being so great. But I mean, it is definitely much more on the consciousness. And I have to think that that has a lot to do with chefs and with the food industry in general, driving that whole sort of consciousness about what the environment needs to protect itself from, you know, sort of rapacious environmental practices that have preceded the last 10 years or so, and which I hope will be slowing down soon. We have only a few more minutes. I have a couple of more questions. What are your goals for the coming decade in terms of specific and measurable actions that you feel the Chefs Collaborative can be taking to sort of further improve the food system?
Wow, that's
you guys have a plan?
Question.
Yeah, that's a big one. That's a big question.
That's a big question. I can jump in first, Michael.
Cool.
I mean, I think we know that to achieve change and track our progress and the effectiveness of our programs, that a set of measurable goals surrounding the actions that we're taking, that our network is taking, is really vital. And, you know, we just celebrated our 20th anniversary last year. Mm. As we move through 2013 and 2014, we've embarked upon an exciting strategic plan for the years ahead to explore just this.
Great.
And, you know, with our oncoming new leadership, which I know you started to ask about, we'll be sharing a lot more on this front, but we're totally, you know, immersed in that process right now and are excited to be moving forward with that.
So you guys, you have a new leader. You have Sarah Brito. Am I saying that right? Sarah
mm-hmm. Brito. Yep.
And so she obviously is coming in with a whole fresh agenda of what she wants to see happen in the next few. Can you share? Has she decided on any of that, or you guys are still thrashing that out? Is that essentially what your message is?
Sarah's been involved with us for quite some time. She's joining us after consulting with us over the past year and a half and volunteering on our board for the past 2 years. Michael, I don't know if you want to jump in there, but she has a really deep history working with mission-driven CEOs, entrepreneurs, creative agencies. You know, we're really thrilled to have her on board.
Mm-hmm.
Before she was with us, she was the chief branding officer and director of community for the Kitchen family of restaurants and nonprofit.
Right.
So she's collaborated really closely with Kimball Musk and Hugo Matheson. And, you know, she's based in Boulder, Colorado, but I can also tell you that before that, she lived in your near and dear Brooklyn.
She did. That's right. She told me that.
And was involved with Flow Food and was one of the brainchilds behind their snail of approval status that you see everywhere now.
Right,
You know, Sarah's really jumping in, and she's helping us with this. I mean, she's leading the summit and then leading the charge with everything ahead. So, you know, we really know that she's going to have some great ideas working with our board and staff to implement in the years ahead.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I mean, I think, you know, you guys have such an opportunity at this point. I mean, I think your organization has, you know, its visibility is rising by the day, and I think that more people are aware of it. And, I'm hoping that that you're able to use all of the information that you gather at these summits and then somehow push that out to the public in a way that lets them know that all of these chefs are basically working on the behalf of the population, not just for their own bottom line. You know, it's like there's a lot going on there. So let's close here, but let's talk about any issues you guys want to bring up, anything you want to add to this conversation. We have about 3 or 4 more minutes to go, and, let's promote. Where can people learn more? How can they get involved? What's going to go on after the summit? Tell me everything.
Okay. Well, the main thing I really want to pass along to everyone is that For chefs and food professionals that are listening, I definitely want to invite everyone to come to the summit. We're really going to be tackling those mountains to move in our food system, antibiotics misuse in meat production, sustainable seafood. We'll be talking a lot about GMOs, so a lot of really timely stuff going on there. Right. And all of the summit details are online. It's chefscollaborative.org. You'll see all of the summit details, the speakers, the schedule. It's all there. We're so excited, and we really hope to have as many people from across the country join us as possible.
Yeah.
So that's something I really want to make sure everybody knows.
And if they can't come to the summit, that a lot of this information will be on your website afterwards, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And really would encourage people to subscribe to our email and to follow us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/chefscollaborative. We have a pretty robust conversation there. We'll share anything from news stories, but really all the programming. We'll have videos. We'll have photos. We'll have all of the information that we're covering will be on social media. And the hashtag for folks that want to follow it on Instagram and Twitter is ChefSummit14, all one word. So we'll be having folks be posting what they're doing, what they're learning, the tangible changes they'll be implementing in their businesses, so you can really get a sense of some of the change and the energy flowing from the summit.
Yeah.
So that's ChefSummit14.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, you guys. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really grateful to you for this opportunity to chat with you about the organization. I think you all do really terrific work. And, I'm looking forward to seeing you both September 28th. And thanks for including
me
in the summit. I really
appreciate
it.
Fabulous. Thank you so much. And we look forward to seeing you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Okay, take care. So we'll see you next week, folks. Thanks for tuning in. And thanks to White Oak Pastures for their sponsorship. As always, a great organization. Definitely check out their website. And I'll see you next week. We'll be talking college dining with the head of UMass Food Service. He serves 45,000 meals a day. So we're talking power. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.